And good afternoon. It is Friday, a beautiful day, 12:03 here in WASR. And as always, one of my guests is New Hampshire Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley and Representative Brody Deshaies. Gentlemen, hello.
Hi, Eric. How are you today? Hi, Brody.
I am well, sir. You working on your bracket, Senator?
You know what? It snuck up on me. I'm not the biggest college basketball fan, so I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, it's okay. If it makes you feel better, I haven't either. So, how you doing, Brody?
I'm well, and thank you. Thank you to the senator for joining and everything, and thanks for having me, Eric. And I did make a bracket. I have Gonzaga winning, and, you know, I always have Gonzaga winning. I've been doing that since my freshman year of college, so 6 years now, and I'm hoping Gonzaga can finally pull through this time around.
They won it last year, didn't they?
You know, I can't remember. I don't follow close enough.
Okay.
The only sport I follow is football, the New England Patriots, and I do follow college football very closely.
Okay. All right, well, let's get right to it, gentlemen. First of all, I wanted to talk to the senator about the redistricting thing that's going on. Governor Sununu, as heard on the Jack Heath show earlier today, said that he was planning on vetoing the bill. Senator, can you kind of expand on what's in it and why the governor doesn't like it?
You know, I think it'd be best to ask him why he doesn't like it. I think he has said, you know, that it should be changed, and I'm assuming he's going to follow through and veto it, as he said, and then hopefully, you know, the people in the House and the Senate who were responsible for drafting the plan can come up with something that meets the governor's approval. So that's the hope.
Okay. Were you happy with the way the maps were drawn?
So I was the lone Republican vote against it because 18 of 21 towns that I represent changed from the first district to the second district, and it was just too much.
Okay. Now, if the governor does veto, do you go back to square one and then start the whole process again?
No, not really. Either the House or the Senate would probably take a bill off the table, hold a public hearing with a new plan, and then it would move through the process that way.
Okay.
So there are ways of doing it. It's not the easiest thing, but there are ways of doing it.
Okay. Do you think that it's going to happen in this session, or are we looking at probably next time?
Excuse me. It has to happen. So if it doesn't, it probably ends up in court, and I don't think anybody wants a court redrawing the district. So,
well, speaking of court decisions, actually, I wanted to talk to you about, we've talked about this before, about education and the Claremont decision. I do remember, if memory serves, that the first couple of attempts were swatted down by the New Hampshire Supreme Court. There seems to be some still question about what constitutes an adequate education. Did that ever get defined in a way that was acceptable?
Well, it got defined by the legislature, I think, back in 2008, and it has been funded ever since. And it's at about $3,700, $3,800 for certain categories of education. Obviously, everybody knows, you know, the average cost of educating a child in New Hampshire is higher than that, but that has been what the state's commitment has been. Over the last two budget cycles, we have put about $250 million of new funding into education in New Hampshire. I think that's pretty noteworthy. And as I, you know, keep reminding people, the way to fund education, or at least in my view, the way to fund education is not through an income tax, which will undermine the New Hampshire advantage that we have and the fact that we're one of the fastest growing states in the Northeast in terms of job opportunities. We have the lowest poverty rate. one of the lowest unemployment rates. We're consistently among the most livable states rated in the nation, one of the safest states. So all of that, to me, speaks to the fact that we should not have an income or sales tax, but we do have a responsibility for education. And the way I believe to do that is to continue to grow the economy. And when you have a growing economy, as we've had, you know, the last several years, we've dedicated that excess revenue, which we're producing a lot of, to education funding. There'll be a bill on the Senate floor next week sponsored by Aaron Hennessey that will continue that trend. So I think, you know, far better to help lower property taxes by having excess state surplus dollars from a growing economy than undermine the economy with an income tax or a sales tax or both to try to fund education. And I think that, you know, this is kind of been the position of New Hampshire voters, that while, you know, some people may not feel that they like their property taxes, they don't want an income tax to replace property taxes, because what's happened in other states that have thought they could do this, substitute an income tax for property taxes, you end up with an income tax and higher property taxes. It just, it always seems to happen. So, you know, we'll see what happens with the Conval lawsuit. There's another lawsuit probably in the time frame of 2023, 2024. There'll be a decision, and we'll have to, you know, see what that decision is and go from there. But again, I don't believe the way to solve any education funding issue is through a sales tax, an income tax, a capital gains tax, or the worst of all for the Lakes region, the statewide property tax, where towns like Wolfboro and Tuftonboro, Moultonboro, and Jackson and Bartlett and Freedom and Sandwich all become donor towns. And that's, of all the solutions, at least in this area, I think the most controversial.
Okay. Brody, let's hear from you on one of your bills that I know we had talked about before on your show a couple of weeks ago. Your raw milk bill, House Bill 1187, you sponsored that bill. That went to committee. What can you tell us about it?
Well, 1187, so first, excuse my cat for meowing, Eric. I don't know if you heard her.
But that's fine.
She was aggrieved. She wanted some food, but she's good now. Anyway, so 1187, I believe, is just being held in committee because we passed House Bill 95, which is the same exact bill with the compromise that we came up with in the Senate with Senator Bradley working with myself and Representative Allard and Representative Woodcock working with to find out why some of the state senators were opposed. So we ended up coming to a compromise that we're going to allow the expansion of raw milk products that can be sold in the state of New Hampshire. We're going to require that raw milk products have a label on it because there can be a risk to women who are pregnant or to the public if they have raw milk, even though it's very rare. It's still a risk that consumers should know about. And by having that amendment, by getting that through the Senate, and by the House concurring, actually, we concurred back on back when we were in Manchester still. I mean, that was a huge deal. It was a 3.5-year process working with the Department of Agriculture in the state and the Department of Health and Human Services to get this bill finally to the governor's desk. And, you know, my assumption is the governor will either sign the bill or just let it, you know, pass into law without his signature. And I think it's going to be a huge win for our local dairy producers, for small farm stands, and just any consumer who wants to be able to have, you know, the dairy product of their choice.
Right.
And it's going to grow this new growing market in the state of New Hampshire of raw milk products in a safe and effective way. And I'm very appreciative that the senator was able to play an instrumental part in getting this bill finally across the finish line. And I was, you know, happy to really take up the baton on behalf of the prime sponsor, Representative Jim Allard, and really, you know, carry this bill from starting in June until, you know, until this process ended in February, of getting it through the Senate and the House and really making a difference.
Senator, can you tell me about your involvement with that bill and what you did to help push it toward passage?
Yeah, we heard it in the Commerce Committee that I'm a member of. Senator French and myself supported it. Senator Susie and Kavanaugh did not support it initially, and Senator Gannon, the fifth member, was kind of on the fence. And so, as Brody said, the compromise that came forward brought Senator Susie, Kavanaugh, and Gannon on board, passed easily. So, you know, I basically just helped try to forge a compromise. I mean, it was a compromise that was brought to us by, you know, the bill sponsors like Brody, who did a great job. And he's right about it having a positive impact on farmers that, you know, raise those kind of animals, goats in particular. So hopefully the governor will sign it and we move on.
All right. It's coming up on 12:15 here in WASR. We're talking with Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley and House Member Brody Deshaies on, here on the Eric Scott Show. Beautiful day. It's up in the 60s today and rain tomorrow. So, okay. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the other bills that you sponsored, Senator, including Senate Bill 264, which is the expanded net metering. I'm a little confused by that. According to what I heard on the radio this morning, it will allow sales of electricity to other producers instead of the big companies. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so we allowed a liberalization last year of net metering. It took a while to get it through the process because there were some folks that thought that there was going to be subsidies to net metering proponents. And remember, what net metering is, if you have solar panels on your house or if you're a big solar farm or a wind farm, you get to sell your power back into the grid at, depending on how much power you have, if it's a small amount of power, it's at the retail rate minus a discount. If it's a larger amount of power, it's at the default service rate. So in any case, took a while to get that through because some people were concerned about cross subsidies. This bill just opens up the process a little bit more in terms of who can sell and who can buy. I think it's more of a technical fix than a large-scale fix. What we had done last year, moved the upper limit of a net metering, you know, a solar farm or a wind farm from 1 megawatt to 5 megawatts. And, you know, that was the big thing last year. So now this is just, as I understand it, who can sell and who can buy. So more of a technical fix.
Who are some of the other providers or producers that would buy the electricity other than the co-op or Eversource or whoever?
Well, they're the ones that then buy the power. And it actually, I don't think the argument about the subsidies is as strong, I guess I'd say, from the proponents of the fact that there are subsidies as they would think. Because what happens, I mean, for instance, the town of Conway has a solar farm at their water and sewer plant. Middleton Lumber down on Middleton Road in Middleton has built a solar farm just south of, you know, the lumber yard. So they sell back into the grid to, you know, the host utility that then they get compensated for the power that they're producing. Okay, that's the way it works. There's usually, like, for instance, the town of Conway uses some of that power. The Middleton supply uses some of that power, but the excess gets sold back into the grid. The reason why I don't believe the subsidies are at the level that some people would claim they are, when you even out the production of electricity throughout the grid with what's known as distributed generation, you have a transmission cost reduction because you're producing power locally as opposed to importing it from further away. And so I think when you take into account all of the benefits of net metering, which is renewable energy, energy diversity, energy security, and then, you know, the fact that you have distributed generation, which lowers transmission costs, I think it's a pretty good deal for all customers, not just, you know, people that, you know, that net meter. Now, in full disclosure, I have a solar system on my house. I am able to sell the REC credits, the renewable energy credits, and I get, I don't know, maybe $30 to $40 a quarter. That it's not a big moneymaker for me because I am not net metering in the Wolfboro, you know, market. So I only get the renewable energy credits. But I did it because I wanted to, you know, be part of producing my own electricity, and I had a pretty good location for it, and I've been quite happy with it.
And how much has it chopped your electric bill, out of curiosity?
You know, it's hard to say, I'll be honest, because at the same time I did that, I upgraded my heating system in my house. I previously it had a kerosene space heater, a monitor, which I have now changed it to propane and have seen, you know, pretty significant cost increases there because of the energy situation. I also heated with wood. So I still heat with wood. I have the propane system that I described, but I also put in three splitters, and they are electric units. They're very efficient in terms of the amount of electricity they use, but there's no question, you know, I did it to have more uniform heat through the house because I just, you know, couldn't, in the coldest days, you know, there were some areas of the house that were 50 degrees, and it was a little cold.
Yeah.
So we, you know, put in these three splitters. So my electric bill in the winter certainly went up. I think in the summer, because I do have, you know, trees around my house, so I have enough shade, and I'm, you know, on Rust Pond, so I get a breeze. It's very rare that I have to use air conditioning. So I think, you know, my electric bill in those months of the years has gone down somewhat. I haven't really tracked it. But now both Karen and I have bought plug-in hybrid Jeeps, and I think it's great. I just plug the thing in at night. It does take about 10 hours to recharge, and I get 25 miles in either Jeep based on an electric motor. So I feel good. I'm producing, you know, power from the solar system that's running my, you know, my car for at least 25 miles. So if you're just using, you know, obviously my trip to Concord back and forth is 80 miles, but, you know, you start thinking, okay, 55 miles, I'm on gas, but 25 miles, I'm not. It actually makes quite a difference.
On that subject, as you know, that there's heating assistance, usually in the fall. It's still heating season with kerosene, which I noticed, at least in my town, had touched $6 a gallon before retreating. Is there anything on the pike to kind of help people with this, any supplemental heating funds?
So, you know, when I was in Congress, that was always a big bone of contention. It was called the low LIHEAP, which is, you know, a low-income heating insurance program, if you will, for people that were of a certain income threshold to get several hundred dollars to help them with their heating bills. Those are all federal funds, and I do believe that with all the money that's been sloshing around from these stimulus bills, that, you know, I've read that LIHEAP has been more funded than normal, so people can apply for that. It's probably too late for 2022 for this winter, but certainly, you know, in the fall through the Tri-County CAP agency in Tamworth.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your affordable housing bill. How is that working out for you? Senate Bill 400. You sponsored that one, right?
I did. It was the governor's bill. There's been some opposition to it. You know, like with a lot of complicated legislation, it's easy to pick apart this piece or that piece. It passed the Senate yesterday. It's on its way to the House. There was some, you know, opposition to it. And I think that, you know, as I told the proponents of the bill yesterday, they're going to need to do, you know, more outreach to, you know, legislators in the House to ensure passage. There's been a lot of housing-related legislation. Another bill that I sponsored that was Senate Bill 210 that dealt with manufactured housing parks. It was labeled an anti-affordable housing bill. That was never the intent. And when, you know, the opponents of the bill came in and talked to me about it, I said, all right, we'll fix that. And we did. What the bill does, and it passed the Senate yesterday too, is when you have a manufactured housing park, and there's several, you know, in this area, they're generally started by an owner of the park, builds the roads, the utilities, and people buy their building, and they put it on a foundation, and they pay a land rent. So a lot of times over the years, the owners decide that they want to sell. And they can sell to other private owners. And there are, you know, some out-of-state owners that are trying to buy manufactured housing parks. And it's not just a New Hampshire issue. It's around the country. And there's the prospect potentially, although it doesn't always happen from what I've been told, of rising land costs. So the other option is for the residents of a manufactured housing park to get together, to form an association, and to work with the community loan fund on financing the ownership by the residents of the manufactured housing park. This has actually been fairly popular. There are 140 of them in New Hampshire. But the problem was that if you were not a member of the association, or if you couldn't attend the one meeting that the association would hold, you didn't have a vote on whether you wanted to have private ownership or become a resident-owned community. Most of the resident-owned communities have worked well, but some have not. And there have been examples of some of these manufactured housing parks, one in Allenstown in particular, when only 22% of the residents in a 300-home park actually voted to become resident-owned. And so what we ended up doing is updating the voting procedure. Okay, it had been you had to show up at a meeting. Sometimes it was at the manufactured housing park, sometimes it was elsewhere, in a church or a school or something like that. It was a one-shot opportunity. We've added more notification and an absentee opportunity so that people could vote by absentee as to whether they, you know, want to do this, because it's a big commitment in terms of costs and in terms of management of the, you know, manufactured housing park. And so, you know, it was a long and laborious process, but hopefully when this bill now gets to the House, we'll see the merits of it so that more people can participate in the process, but we haven't undermined at all the ability to form a resident-owned community, which is what some of the proponents of resident-owned communities were afraid of. So a good compromise. So I think, you know, that'll move forward. And then there was a bill, and maybe Brody can talk about this one, 1177, that my understanding is was tabled in the House that would have allowed for a lot more multifamily dwellings if you were on town water and sewer. But I'll let Brody talk about that one.
Brody?
Yeah, 1177, that was let me pull up my notes, because there was a few bills that we tabled yesterday.
So I was a co-sponsor of it. And look, I've had some people call me up about it. They thought that it kind of went too far. I think the way it was written, I would agree with that. It went too far. But the problem with affordable housing in New Hampshire is, number one, it's a huge problem. It's holding back the ability of our economy to grow. The average price of a single-family home is about $400,000. There are an awful lot of people that cannot afford that kind of price tag in New Hampshire. The vacancy rate for apartment dwellings is less than 1%. So rents are increasing and are becoming less and less affordable. And so we absolutely have to increase the housing stock in New Hampshire. It's absolutely critical that we do it with those kind of price tags that are out there. So the other bill that I was talking about, Senate Bill 400, seeks to do that in a number of different ways that are not mandates on towns. And that's where the rub comes in. When you mandate a zoning issue from Concord, you know, people find that, you know, difficult to deal with. But a lot of towns have exclusionary zoning. And even though we have put $50 million, and that's been largely my efforts with legislation, into the budget for the Affordable Housing Fund, which partners with developers to build multifamily housing, it's not enough. And we, you know, hopefully towns will realize it's in their best interest to, you know, open more opportunities for multifamily housing, affordable housing, rental housing than we have in New Hampshire right now. And to, you know, some stick-built housing or manufactured housing too. But that's, you know, you can't have, if you want to be a growing state, you can't have the average price of a home $400,000 and the rental at less than 1%, the vacancy rate. It's a real problem.
Yeah, it is. And the only problem I see with affordable housing is you got to find out where to put it, because no one seems to want it near them. And I've never understood that.
Well, and that's the problem. And again, the bill that Brody's looking up, 1177, thought the purpose of it was to jumpstart multifamily housing on water and sewer. But there were a lot of legitimate issues that were raised by people. So I suspect that's why that bill got tabled. But, you know, these issues are going to keep coming back because of, you know, the overall statewide problem that we're having. You can't attract a younger workforce starting out in their career that, whether they rent or buy, they have to have a place to live. And, you know, with housing so tight right now, it's definitely, it's probably the biggest single impediment that we have in New Hampshire toward economic growth, which is why I think there's been bipartisan support, you know, for a lot of the initiatives that we've done on a state level. And we need that to also play out, you know, in towns around the state.
Brody, have you found your notes on 1177?
Yeah, I remember what this bill is. Again, I spoke with our Board of Selectmen about this bill. And the major issue specifically for Wolfboro would be the fact that we would need to increase our sewer capacity a precipitous amount. right, and the sewer. So first we would have to increase the sewer capacity first, and then the amount of sewer hookup fees that we'd get, you know, well, that was the other issue. We wouldn't get any new sewer hookup fees to offset the cost of increasing our sewer capacity. Wolfboro's downtown sewer is already basically maxed out, right, which is part of the issue why the recent development, the Berrywood Mills, was denied by the ZBA, was because we just didn't have the current infrastructure for our sewer and our water to be able to do that. And so the bill would have been mandating a shift in the density of communities from our local ZBA and our planning board to the state. So you'd see a lot of single-family homes in Wolfboro, you know, that are on, like, North Main Street and everything, or, you know, in some area, you know, by Center Street, where a developer could buy the property and then automatically turn it into, instead of one house with four people in it, turn it into a four-unit house with, you know, 16 to 20 people in it. And so all of a sudden you're seeing these residential lots turn from single family to four family, and we just don't have the infrastructure to deal with such, you know, fast growth, right? And so that's part of the thing where we need to strike a balance where we look at the reality of housing and the issue that we have and figure out a way to get young people into homes that are affordable in communities like Wolfboro. But we can't do it in a way that makes it so then it's just going to overrun our infrastructure, overtax our property taxpayers, and make it so then you know, we're not bringing about an equitable way of creating more housing and increasing the housing supply. You know, 1177 would have ruined local control in a number of ways that just weren't reconcilable to our local leaders.
And that bill was tabled, you said?
It was tabled, but tabled, I mean, now it's dead because we tabled it, and at the end of the night, you know, all the deadlines passed, so it's not going to the Senate, not going to the governors.
Okay.
It's done. It was tabled because it died. No, we didn't take an action on it, so you could bring back an amendment and attach it to another bill as change. But the issue was the concept and how, you know, making it, you know, single residential lots turn into four overnight and incentivizing that kind of growth, even if it's pre-existing buildings, a lot of small communities wouldn't have been able to handle that infrastructure increase. In Manchester and Nashua, you know, Derry, a number of other places, they could handle that kind of infrastructure increase and everything, and they have the tax base for it. But it was smaller towns with sewer systems like Stewartstown, Littleton, Wolfboro. I don't know if Conway has a sewer system, but if they do, you know what I mean? Those are the communities where taxpayers, property taxpayers, would have had to basically subsidize a precipitous growth in housing without any control, right? And we need growth. We need more housing, but it has to be controlled in a responsible way without affecting everyone's property tax bills in a crazy way.
Well, when you look at it in Wolfboro, if you say the water and sewer is maxed out, how would we be able to fix that problem without expanding the system?
Well, and that's the very thing that was the issue with the bill, is that there was no way for the state to reconcile of how, you know, how we would increase that without increasing property taxes and increasing our sewer capacity and water capacity, which is very expensive. We're already having to redo the entire system, and we're bonding a project for multi-millions of dollars, even subsidized by the ARPA money. It's still going to cost us a lot of money going forward. And to do that and to have to expand capacity, it would have just been too much for our property taxpayers. And that was, I mean, there was no way that the state was going to help us offset those costs. It'd be one thing to do this and for the state to promise some certain amount of money to help us expand our you know, our infrastructure, but that's just not the case. So, and, you know, when we weren't going to see a lot of the way that we subsidize expansion in our water and our sewer is by charging a fee to hook up to the water and sewer system, but the fees that we wouldn't have seen an increase in the number of hookups, right? Because, you know, there's still going to be one hookup that runs from the water system to what was formerly a one unit, you know, single family residency that would then become a four unit, you know, four family residency. Right. So now we're not getting any hookup fees for the other three new families. So there's no offset to the infrastructure costs.
Okay. And you said there was no state funding for this either.
To my understanding, no. I could be mistaken. But to my understanding,
Let me jump in. Dollars for water and sewer upgrades. We're going to continue to do that. But I think Brody makes a good point, and that's why the bill appropriately was tabled.
So there's really no hope for affordable housing in Wolfboro anytime soon?
No, I wouldn't say that,
Eric.
Okay. Senator, you first.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say that. I think that it will take a partnership of the town, the development community, a developer, and the Affordable Housing Fund to do, a project like Harriman Hill. So there's definitely the opportunities to do that. That's where the $50 million that we've put into the Affordable Housing Fund over the last several years comes in, to provide those kind of opportunities. So that's available. We are investing a lot in water and sewer upgrades. That, doesn't happen overnight, but it will. I think Brody makes a really good point about, the situation in Wolfboro in terms of the sewer. But this kind of a zoning change was probably, from the state, too much, too fast, and hadn't been thought out well enough. So I think appropriately so was tabled.
Okay. Let's move on here on WASR. It's 12:39. Good afternoon. Here's an interesting one I saw. It's got bipartisan sponsorship, House Bill 1134, labeling disposable wipes. Didn't know that was a problem, but can either of you tell me a little bit, maybe Brody, you can look that one up, as far as why we need to do that?
I can speak to that, Senator, if you'd like me to.
Yeah, no, please.
Let me find the exact language, Eric, but I could definitely, I've never seen the bill, but I can definitely imagine why communities would want this required.
Well, they usually, if they're labeled as disposable, theoretically, you can put them in, you can flush them and they go through the sewer system. Is that a problem?
I'm not sure how big of a problem it is, and I don't agree with the government mandating in that, but I would assume that's the problem that the sponsors would be trying to solve, right? Because that's a huge issue in a lot of sewer systems, is people flushing unflushable wipes, there are other things, and it ends up creating infrastructure costs. But I just couldn't imagine the state of New Hampshire creating on its own, being so cavalier and creating a mandate onto businesses and actually expecting, these businesses to change all their packaging just to comport with our mandate. But I can understand the logic, right? It's a huge issue in a lot of places and in a lot of sewer systems too. I don't know how big of an issue it is in Wolfboro. I assume people are pretty smart and they don't flush non-flushable wipes down the toilet. But I know of people who have run into the issue with their septic systems or in our, I live in a community where we have shared septic systems, and sometimes we end up having a problem with the septic system and we find out that a family has been flushing things that shouldn't be flushed. So I can imagine it happening on a much larger scale and maybe other places, but it's never a good idea to introduce mandates onto businesses to try to solve a problem where a community could just, educate its populace a little bit more and explain why it's not a good idea for taxpayers and for public health to be flushing things that shouldn't be flushed.
Right. Okay, it's 12:42 here in WASR. Senator, I want to talk to you about a bill you sponsored, House Bill 1005, creating a low-grade timber commission. Is this something that we kind of decide how to market lower-grade timber, whether it's through energy generation or building or to provide a market for this stuff?
We've had a huge amount of debate and controversy about the biomass industry in New Hampshire and its importance to New Hampshire. Obviously, I've worked over the last several years to try to keep the
biomass power plants alive, and, you know, I'm continuing that effort with the one in Berlin. All of the independent plants, with the exception of one, have closed their doors. So there hopefully is a outlet for low-grade wood, wood chips in particular, that had been previously burned, and there was about, I don't know, 150 megawatts of, you know, homegrown renewable energy in New Hampshire. Now it's down to about 75, maybe 90 with this one independent plant. And that large plant in Berlin, which is 75 megawatts, is struggling financially just because of the reimbursement rate that they're getting in the stipulation from the Public Utilities Commission about how they get paid. So this bill, this commission, is designed to be an opportunity to at least discuss the opportunities for low-grade wood in New Hampshire, whether it's sort of a renewable natural gas situation that, you know, the technology is increasingly looking as if wood chips can be economically turned into, you know, a natural gas product, or other outlets for low-grade wood. So that's what it is, Eric. It's designed to be a commission to explore ideas of how to protect the forest products industry in New Hampshire, which there are a lot of jobs. I do continue to believe these power plants are important for our energy security, given what's going on in the world. Having a homegrown source of energy, especially in New England, where there's, you know, supply constraints, not on a day like today that is beautiful and, you know, temperatures warm, but if it's very hot or very cold, the operator of the grid in New England has warned of, rolling blackouts in the future if we don't have more capacity. So I think it's difficult to shut down even more power plants, especially one that, you know, is renewable energy. There is a cost to it. I'm fully aware of that, but I think in the overall scheme of things, it's a very small cost given the jobs and, you know, the fact that it's a homegrown energy source.
Why have those plants closed? Is it they weren't able to get enough for their power at the market rate, or were there other factors?
Yeah, well, the market rate did not cover their cost of, you know, operating the plant and buying the fuel. So they were selling into the spot market, which is about, you know, 3 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. In order to cover their costs, they needed something in the range of 7 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour. And there was never the wherewithal to have them as dedicated to the part of the power that is called default service that electric utilities buy for customers that don't make a competitive choice. So that might have been at one time a good solution, but it never happened. So they were getting a subsidy to keep them alive, but that subsidy has run out and the plants have closed, except this one in Bridgewater and in Berlin, where they had a specific rate order with the Public Utilities Commission. But that rate order does not allow them also to cover their costs, and they have a built-up deficit, if you will, that if we don't find a way for them to, you know, recover that and move forward, that plant probably will shutter too, which would be, I think, unfortunate, not only for, you know, power security in New England and New Hampshire, but also, you know, the health of the forest, because there has to be an outlet for low-grade wood.
Right. Well, besides pellets and pallets, you got to do something with it. And it's unfortunate that those plants have closed, I think. Were there environmental issues on this as well, burning wood?
Well, when you look at energy, you always have to, at least in my opinion, look at the overall construct of, you know, different sources of energy to produce electricity. So, you know, solar, there are people that object to solar energy because it means that you have to use a lot of open, vacant land, and some people don't want to look at it. There are people that object to wind on the tops of mountains where the wind blows, because that's where you can get wind power. And the people object to the noise and the flashing red lights because of the airplane beacons. Obviously, natural gas is a cleaner fuel than coal, but people don't want to live next to natural gas transmission lines because of fear of explosion and fire. That's been a problem. Then, you know, we were highly dependent on burning coal for a long time. We've moved to more natural gas. Obviously, coal is the, of all the hydrocarbon fuels, the dirtiest. And while coal gasification is a possibility, it's still pretty expensive. And then, you know, there's carbon sequestration criteria, things like that. And then, you know, lastly, burning oil, always the most expensive, somewhat dirty, and nuclear power, which, while I think it's at least in the United States proven to be, you know, very safe, there continue to be problems in terms of how do we deal with the long-term disposal of, you know, spent fuel rods. So when you try to figure out, you know, is wood good or bad, you sort of have to look at it in terms of the continuum. There are, you know, you are producing steam and heat and some particulate matter, but in terms of, you know, some of the other burning issues with hydrocarbons, there are far fewer emissions of, like, sulfur or nitrogen or, you know, other things, and it is much more carbon neutral because you're burning trees. Well, the trees have had to grow, and presumably they'll be replaced with trees that grow. So in the overall scheme of things, wood is a far better source of energy than a lot of others in terms of environmental impact. But they all have an impact.
Is it time, you think, for another nuclear plant in New England somewhere?
I would support that if there could be, you know, a good location that was chosen. You know, Seabrook 2 would have been helpful. But we've, in New England, I mean, one of the reasons that we, you know, have supply constraints is I believe we have closed 5 nuclear power plants out of 9. We still have a couple left, Seabrook being one of them. Millstone in Connecticut is another one. But, you know, we've closed 2 plants in Connecticut, 2 in Massachusetts, 1 in Vermont. That I can think of, and that's led to, you know, the fact that we just don't have enough, you know, of our own resources in this area of the country, and we depend on importation. In particular, natural gas has replaced nuclear, and trust me, nobody wants a natural gas pipeline to come anywhere near their neighborhood or a school or a business. It just, even though the vast majority of time natural gas pipelines are, you know, relatively safe.
Is there any way to maybe attack things from the demand side, maybe some kind of incentive for cutting your usage by X amount of percent?
Well, one of the best ways to you know, help with an energy situation is either energy efficiency or its cousin, improving technology. So like the Jeep I talked about, that, you know, Karen and I have, you know, we plug it in and we get 25 miles and we're producing some of that power, at least from our solar system. So, you know, that's technology advancement, and that's happening. And electric cars, while they're out of reach of an awful lot of people, plug-in hybrids are becoming more popular. And I think, you know, 8 or 9 years from now, more and more people are going to be buying electric cars because the technology will advance and the price will come down and come down dramatically, as long as, you know, we have the capability of producing the kind of batteries, because you need things like nickel and lithium. And we're seeing what's happening there with the situation in Ukraine and China.
Right.
So, you know, that's one thing. Then energy efficiency is the cousin of that. And, you know, if you look at what the new light bulbs have done in terms of energy efficiency, it's dramatic. And so, again, a technology, and there's opportunities for people to weatherize their homes and make, you know, energy efficiency upgrades in the way they live. And that is some of the cheapest source of new power, sort of the avoided expansion of use of power. Of course, we all have more and more electronic apparatus in our homes and our businesses and, you know, computers, and they're on, you know, on sleep mode 24/7 most of the time. So our demand is also going up too.
You know, it's funny. I cut my electricity bill about 15% by putting in those Curlicue light bulbs, and it was painless. You know, you just replace your bulbs, and I'm saving quite a bit of money every month. It's amazing how much it matters.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it definitely is.
Brody, I want to ask you one thing about HB 1000. Right now it's in the Senate Transportation Committee, so maybe, Senator, you can talk about it as well. It prevents motorcycle profiling. I didn't know that was a problem. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I believe it was on the consent calendar. I haven't really learned a lot about it, but I know this is Speaker Sherm Packard's bill, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Can you define what being on the consent calendar is?
Yep, consent calendar is when no one has any opposition to the bill.
Okay, and then it
so it goes onto a specific calendar that we adopt as a House just by a voice vote, and we just quickly pass all the bills that everyone is in complete agreement with.
Okay. Have you heard from...
So no one...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so no one opposed this bill, and so it wasn't controversial, and those bills very much will... they will slide under the radar. You know, you won't really, you know, learn too much about them or the subject and everything. But if a bipartisan bill like this passes the House and gets it through committee with a unanimous vote, and Democrats and Republicans are in agreement, then it must have been a very legitimate issue, and it must be a pretty comprehensive bill.
Okay, so you haven't heard from your constituents about this issue?
No.
Okay.
I haven't heard of not I. You know, this is the first I've actually second time I've ever actually heard about.
Okay, Senator, have you heard about this somehow?
No,
that,
I haven't.
Okay, that profiling motorcyclists is a problem, and you haven't.
I haven't heard about it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
But I will say this about Speaker Packard. He's been a long time motorcycle enthusiast. You know, I've ridden with him and his colleague, Bob Letourneau, who's a former senator, and they've really done a lot to protect the rights of people that motorcycle. And it's a big, you know, it's a big deal. People love to come to New Hampshire and cruise on our roads, and I think it's great. Looking forward to, you know, Bike Week, which is coming up soon.
Yeah, it is.
Eric, I'm going to have to sign off. I have another call at 1 o'clock that I have to do, okay?
I understand. Thank you, Senator, for your time, and we'll talk next week.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, you take care. It is 12:57 here on WASR. Brody Deshays, you still with me?
I'm still here.
Okay, great. So getting back to the what we said at the beginning of the show, we have just a couple of more minutes. Your bracket, is it busted already?
Oh yeah, of course. It's a bracket not being busted is nearly impossible.
Well, yeah, but it's early yet.
It is. I mean, yeah, it is early.
Okay. What's going on at when's your next session, and what's on the agenda?
Next session. Sorry, my cat's meowing. next session, we're going to be acting on bills that came out of a second committee. So basically, bills that passed the first committee and then passed the House the first time, we'll then address them again. I think the only controversial bill is going to be one that deals with the scope of the Fetal Protection Act, and that's going to be about it. The Fetal Life Protection Act, I should say. And I think that's going to be the only controversial bill. I think everything else, for the most part, will be voice votes, divisions, or roll calls, but not a lot of debate because we've already done the debate. And we already know, you know, what the results of the bills were because they already passed the House once. So it'll be pretty much, you know, getting everything that we need to get done and sent over to the Senate on time before April 1st. And, you know, we'll probably spend 9 a.m. to about 5 p.m. in session, and then we'll be ready for all the Senate bills to come over in April, and we'll do everything all over again, but with Senate bills.
If it passed the House already, why does it need to pass again?
It goes to second committees because specifically, typically, it's finance. Finance has to look at the fiscal impact or ways and means and really understand, because the first committee tends to be a policy committee, and then the second committee tends to be a financial ways and means or finance. Sometimes you'll have a bill that starts in a committee like education and then goes to like municipal and county because there might be two policy committees that need to really look into it. So it's really dependent. It's up to the judgment of the chairman of the committee and also deciding whether or not it's a two committee bill is a determination of the speaker at the beginning of the session. So there's a number of bills where the speaker said, you know, these need to go to two committees based on, you know, making sure that it gets a comprehensive look. And then the chairman of the committee, you know, will, when it goes to a second committee, will decide whether or not they actually need to take a comprehensive look at it.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Brody Deshaies, thank you very much for being with us, state representative and school board member at the Governor Wentworth School District as well. That's going well for you, by the way?
It's going wonderful. I was sworn in on Monday.
Good for you. All right. Congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Eric.
All right, we'll talk again. You take care. All right, bye now. It is 1 o'clock on WASR. News is next.